On paper, today's guest and I are an odd couple for a podcast. We come from different places politically, but our common ground is the search for truth. When truth becomes subservient to our tribe, we're all doomed. My guest on this podcast is a rare breed, a nonfiction writer who tries to report the truth rather than trying to score political points. His work focuses on technology and entertainment, future kind of technology topics. He's the best-selling author of Console Wars, Sega, Nintendo, and The Battle That Defined a Generation. That book is being developed for TV by producers Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg. His latest book is called The History of the Future, Oculus, Facebook, and the Revolution That Swept Virtual Reality. It is a fantastic book that tells the dramatic story of a guy named Palmer Luckey. He's the founder of the virtual reality company, Oculus, that eventually ran afoul of Mark Zuckerberg in Facebook for having the wrong political worldview. This is fascinating, no matter who Palmer Luckey was for in a presidential campaign. But it is also a timely story that reveals the dark side of big tech politics that no one in mainstream media has bothered to dig into. Until my guest today. He's not a guest that you will see really on any mainstream media. He was an A-list guest for his last book, They Can't Even Find the Alphabet for him now. So what is the history of our future? Will we be truth tellers, or will we remain caged by our own tribalism? Our guest for that answer is Blake J. Harris. So if I would have told you that you would be sitting at this table with me in 2019. If I would have said that to you in 2016, what would you have said?
I would have said the evil Glenn Beck we're talking about. Something like that.
Right, right.
But then again, and I'm sure we'll get into it, but if I've learned one thing over the past few years working on this book, it's to definitely be skeptical of what you read about people in the media. Yeah. So actually by 2019, I'd say I'd be very interested in meeting Glenn. I don't think we'll get along on much.
Yeah.
But we did.
I don't have a problem. In fact, I just have to start with complimenting you. How rare you are to find somebody that actually will tell the truth when it personally hurts. I know a lot of people like, no, I'll tell the truth. But when it comes down to it, no, they won't. No, they won't. Because they have an agenda, or because in your case, you're going to be destroyed. That's what was facing you. We're going to destroy you. How hard is that to tell the truth?
I still don't think it's my job. I mean, I it seems hard for other people to do it, and I don't think I'm that special of a journalist. I really appreciate the compliment, but when I signed up to write this book or to be a storyteller and a journalist telling nonfiction stories, that's just what
you do.
But it never really even occurred to me, in terms of considering the consequences, thinking about that, you know, the media that had loved me for my first book would hate me for this one, or that I would face pushback from Facebook or any of that stuff. My response was just, all right, I need to line up my next book and make sure it's not based on getting access to a tech company, not maybe I should massage the truth to make it.
There was never any time that you thought this is not worth it. Not to lie, but just to not tell the truth.
No, and that's, I think that's less about my integrity and more just about Palmer. In two ways, seeing what happened to Palmer Luckey, seeing how much he became hated in Silicon Valley. Yeah, so, you know, seeing how hated Palmer was and the vitriol directed at him from the media, from the people. As I told you in that email, like, it was never going to be that bad for me. So I felt like I can't complain if he didn't complain. And then the other is just his character. I know him probably better than almost anyone in the world at this point, talking to him every day for the last few years. You know, except for maybe his girlfriend, now fiance. I needed to do right by him. You know, I needed to get the story out. Yes, he supports a politician that I find very objectionable. but the thing that did bond me and Palmer, and the reason why I've in retrospect believe I was selected to tell this story and got this incredible access from Oculus and Facebook, is because I really always bonded with Palmer over our mutual love of the First Amendment.
Yeah.
I thought that, you know, we had conversations about it in terms of a virtual reality, like, you know, in a virtual environment, what should the rules be? You know, should it be, I remember one time we talked about it, like, should it be like a my house, my rules thing? So, yeah. Glenn, if you want to use a lot of four-letter words, that's fine. You know, everyone sets it up. And these were things I didn't really think about because I also took them for granted. Like, I think a lot of people do, and we can't anymore. So, yeah, it was tough. It was excruciating at times. It was exhausting. For me, the hardest part was less the reception or lack of reception or the impact on my career, potentially or actually, but it was seeing Facebook lie to my face systematically.
You were a fan of Mark Zuckerberg,
yeah,
and Facebook.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't have like a, you know, like a,
yeah,
number
a
one
fanboy.
Fan.
Yeah.
But I thought, like also going back to your question of how would I have felt meeting you back before I knew you, and mm-hmm. just from what I read, you know, I do really admire entrepreneurs so much.
Yeah.
So even. Even like Alex Jones, who I find pretty vile, he's put together a pretty good business with InfoWars. I kind of admire that.
Yeah, I mean, it is like a little cartel in a way.
Right.
You know, but
so yes. Yeah, I don't know if I really admire, but I really admired Mark for his sticking with his mission of connecting people for setting up this company.
I will tell you that I met Mark and was at Facebook, and I've got my problems with Facebook. But he's a genuine feeling kind of guy. You don't see him when you meet him and you're talking to him. He really seems like, look, we're just trying to do the right thing, you know, and this is the company that we're doing and this is how we're trying it. And why would I want to edit anybody's speech? Why would I want to do any of that? I don't want to control all that. And you believe him. And I've stuck up for Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah. Until recently, I took a lot of heat. That's not what's happening at Facebook.
So you had mentioned when I was on the show that you had stuck up for Mark and that you had the same feeling about him that I did, and I would have went to bat for him. And then you said you no longer believe him. When did that start to change for you, that you became skeptical of what he and Facebook were
doing? Just the actions of what they were doing. You know, it just doesn't, I'm sorry, you can only say, oh, that was a mistake or that was just an oversight. Yeah. You can only say that so many times before you go, you know, I don't think so. And I'm growing concerned, and I want to talk about this later, with his insistence on, I want regulation. Yeah. No entrepreneur ever says, I want the government regulation. And I have a theory, and I want to pass it by you.
All right, yeah.
As we go. But let's start with Palmer.
Sure.
Palmer is, this is the greatest American, this is... You don't think of Steve Jobs being able to start Apple again. You don't. I mean, what's his name from Microsoft? Bill Gates said you couldn't start Microsoft today. So you don't think of somebody in a little trailer who's just got this crazy idea being able to become a titan overnight.
Right. And it's so Palmer. For anyone who's read the book or knows Palmer, that it was a camper trailer parked in his parents' driveway in Long Beach and not a garage. Because, you know, now there's this fabled idea that Apple was started by the Steves in a garage, mm-hmm. and everyone sort of copies it, homage. But, you know, the whole thing with Apple was think different. People are thinking similarly to think differently. You know, Palmer really is an original. Love him or hate him, you're not gonna find another Palmer Luckey. And for me as a writer, what better way to start the story than with this kid?
How old was he?
He was 19 years old. And by the way, this is a tangent, but I was pulling up the novel that I wrote in college when I was 21 and reading it over the weekend just because I was going through all stuff. And I was like, this is such garbage. This guy thought he was smart. And I was like, wow. And I was 2 years older than Palmer when he started this billion-dollar company.
Yeah.
So I forget that at times, you know, because he's so precocious. And he's just also so himself. You know, we'll get into it later. But a lot of people... the ones who still talk to me about Palmer, they usually say, they try to excuse his actions and say, oh, but he was very young, donating to this Trump organization. You know, like, he'll learn or he'll mature. And I was like, we can agree whether it was a good decision to do that or not, but I'm pretty sure 40 years from now, it's going to be the same guy, yeah. especially now that he has money, because he is himself, and that, as a writer, you know, those are the people that you...
They're interesting.
Yeah, they're very interesting.
So when did he start tinkering with things? How did he...
Oh, yeah, it's a good question. So, you know, the book starts in April 2012 when he's discovered by John Carmack, this legendary programmer that viewers and listeners might know from creating games like Doom and Quake and first-person shooters, and he's a pioneer in that genre. But I always kind of found it fascinating and almost a little unfair to him that the book starts in 2012. That's when he founds mm-hmm. Oculus. But there's also this like whole other story of the 3 years that led to this thing. You know, we talked about it being like this great American dream story, the American dream in 2012 or 2019. And it's, you know, you start with like the product, the thing. And to get to that thing, though, he had to go through 3 years of working on this. So he started in 2009.
But can I put that in perspective? Tesla came to the United States. He spent decades toiling and working. I mean, things have changed so much that somebody with a good idea can take it to market pretty much finished in 3 years.
Yeah. Or actually, things have changed so much that you can sell it for billions of dollars before even finishing the product, which does feel like a very right. America in the 21st century sort right. of story. But you're totally right, too. And that's why I love the story, not just because I think Palmer's this incredible character and a great proxy for our times and just a great inspiration, but because it is an ensemble story, you know, without Brendan Arib, his partner, who becomes the CEO and makes the initial investment.
How old is he?
Brendan is a couple years older than me. I'm 36. So he must have been like 32 or so. You know, I remember.
How did they know each other?
They didn't know each other, and that's like a credit to Brendan. Brendan received a tip, you know, it's described in the book as like the scene from Back to the Future where Marvin Berry calls up, says you gotta listen to this new sound. Yeah. And like he gets this call that, you know, you gotta check out this Palmer Luckey kid. He dazzled at this video game trade show. And Brendan, before even trying a demo, already invested like $200,000, which I think you could say he's either a true believer or he's a serial risk taker, and I think it's a little bit of both. But they really hit it off. They had a dinner together that was chronicled in the book and really sort of foreshadowed a lot of what was to come. And I remember the first time I met with Brendan after I was given this access, and he asked me back, this was February 2016, you know, what's your vision for the book? I said, it's way too early. Especially it was way too early. I had no idea where it was going. But I said, I kind of imagine it's the marriage between you and Palmer, between the entrepreneur and the inventor. And you know, I think it's interesting to think that it still would have been the same invention, but without people like Brendan, without an endorsement from John Carmack, without all these people coming together, it wouldn't have been successful. It wouldn't have been successful in this way. And then, you know, but Palmer's the one who's on the cover of Wired, the cover of Time, the cover of Popular Mechanics. So people think it's a one-man show. That leads to some resentment amongst the group.
Right, right.
But at least that was positive media coverage compared to what was to come.
Yeah. So tell me about Oculus and how big of a leap this was for the industry.
Sure. So, you know, Oculus is a virtual reality company. Palmer's, you know, one of the great things about this book that I didn't have this luxury with my last one, which was from the 90s, was that all the stuff was archived, or a lot of the stuff was archived. I ended up getting emails and other private exchanges, but, you know, he had an original website for Oculus and described this as his tilt to try to make virtual reality happen. Virtual reality had failed so many times over the past several decades.
Why?
Because it was, for a lot of reasons. I mean, first of all, I would say that Oculus did sell the Facebook for $3 billion, but they're not even necessarily a success now, even with mm-hmm. all those resources. But largely... Technology, it was very expensive. That was a huge barrier. And then it's this chicken and egg problem. You know, you're selling a virtual reality headset or goggles or glasses or whatever form factor it's going to be. And that's the hardware. But the hardware is worthless without the software.
That's why Magic Leap sold their products out to producers first.
Right, exactly. And that was something I mentioned Brendan Arib, the CEO. That was one of his ideas. With, you know, originally Palmer's plan was to start a do a Kickstarter and only sell this to people who were enthusiasts like him. And there was, you know, less than 100 people in the world who cared about virtual reality. And Brendan wasn't saying, oh, let's sell it to Blake and Glenn just yet. Let's sell it to the producers. Let's sell it to the developers. Mm-hmm. So that way we'll create this ecosystem and try to solve this chicken egg problem. And that was no easy proposition. But that, in hindsight, was one of the things that, you know, underratedly was a big part of the success, you know, knowing your customer. It's also a good thing to contrast to now, which I'm sure we'll get into with Mark and what his vision for VR. But I think the biggest problem I would say for Oculus right now is that they don't know their customer. That the way that it's been phrased to me is that Mark would rather sell a million headsets to the right people, and by right means like a demographically representative group of people, than he would to sell 10 million units today to the actual demand, which is... this happens with other companies too now, where it's like it's not really capitalism. It's like activism slash capitalism, where you're not trying to supply demand. You're trying to create assertive demand, not in the way of like where Steve Jobs would say, you know.
So tell me the difference. Tell me the difference between that and a fashion designer that just will not make size 12 dresses. I mean, isn't that kind of the same thing? They want their product on a certain look, and they don't want it on, you know, the average everyday person.
No, it's a good comparison. Especially because, you know, if you look at the thinking with how Facebook has proceeded with VR and AR, and AR is augmented reality. When I talked to the executives back before I was blackballed, they had a sample size experience of one major success starting Facebook, and so they often thought about VR in terms of Facebook. And one thing that they talked about was that Facebook, unlike MySpace or Friendster or these other social network companies, Facebook had an almost equal mix of men and women, and that was enticing. You know, it was like basically a social media network is like a party, and you're like saying, "Come on in." So, in that respect, you know, designing the dresses for fashionable people is there is a comparison to be made. Though I feel like the motivation is different here. I think that so much of the rhetoric at Facebook and some of their decision and a lot of their decision making seems based on inclusivity and you know, it doesn't...
When you say inclusivity, what you really mean is exclusivity, making sure that only a certain group get it and not another group.
Right. I mean, like, I spoke with a lot of, in addition to people at Oculus and Facebook, I spoke with a lot of developers, a lot of white male developers, and they were explicitly told that Facebook was not looking in that direction for you know, that sort of creator, which is... crazy, because they're actually creating something. You'll never even know what these people look like. I guess it trickles down in some way maybe to their aesthetic, but really, I mean, this is obviously a much larger cultural question, but it's just so weird that you could watch a movie like The Godfather now and say, you know, this is Francis Ford Coppola made this, and people would have a different opinion than if you say Tina Fey made this. I mean, it shouldn't really matter.
Look at Game of Thrones. You watch Game of Thrones, and then you see the guy who wrote Game of Thrones, you're like, well, that doesn't match.
Right.
You know what I mean? It doesn't... What difference does that make?
Right. And this is an issue that I care about a lot, and we are probably pretty aligned on, because I come at it from the perspective as an artist, as a creator.
Yeah.
I want to write about people like Palmer. I want to write about interesting people of all ethnicities, genders. I don't care. So... to feel, you know, it does seem more and more like if I were to write a book with a female protagonist, I would be concerned about some sort of appropriation or anything along those lines, which is really antithetical to why I got into storytelling.
Yeah. And antithetical to what we've always been taught from Martin Luther King.
Right.
Judge me by the content of my character, you know, just judge my work, not what are you looking at me for?
Right. And that's, you know, I will say that part of this is a great example of this story. You asked me, you know, like it was, I had to bite my tongue at times when I was writing it, because while conveying these subjective perspectives, I conveyed why people like Trump and I don't like Trump. But that is partly why I wanted to write. I wanted to get inside other people's heads. I wanted to understand that. And it made me
a better person
for it, or at least I'm a happier person for knowing that. And it's just been kind of saddening. Like this experience really did open my eyes to just always thinking about that Martin Luther King Jr. quote. And talking to, I mean, I guess now there's, I, at the time, I think that like a lot of liberals, I was kind of blind to the big divide between maybe a new left or a very progressive left and more of a classical liberal or people like me who had always voted Democrat, and getting into the more of the cultural issues. This really opened my eyes up to that. And when I talk to some of my ultra progressive friends and bring that quote up, it's always just there's this asterisk, like, well, yeah, eventually that'll be the goal. But we have to, you know, offset all these years of oppression. And I'm sympathetic to try and offset that. But like, do you have a formula? Like, what is it? And it's more just like, well, we'll know when we see it. I mean, I don't know. This is not pornography where we just know when we see that. Yeah. And you got, you know, hundreds of millions of people in this country. I don't think people are going to be cool with a we'll know when we see it perspective.
Yeah, and it's not changing hearts. It's hardening hearts. It's hardening hearts.
Right.
We worked so hard to break down barriers between us, and we were nowhere near finished by any stretch of the imagination, but we had made some really good progress to where I really believe a majority of people, 80%, really just didn't see color. They just didn't. I mean, you're good at what you do. I don't really care. And I think that a lot of that is reversing now. But people are seeing white, they're seeing black, they're seeing handicapped. We're just categorizing people into groups instead of saying, we're all human. Now, right. What do you bring to the table?
Right. And that's something that I'm sure you were aware of and had your pulse on much earlier than I did. And that has really become clear to me in the past few years. And it's really disconcerting. Partly too, because, you know, as a journalist, objectivity is my North Star. And then I hear people, some of these terrible journalists, or just skeptics say, well, there's no such thing as objectivity. And then it's like, we can argue whether that's true or not. And then they just basically respond like, well, all the rules are out, so we can be as subjective as we want to be. And I agree that maybe there's no such thing as true. There's probably no such thing as true objectivity, but it's a goal.
Yeah, it's a right. goal. It's I've met with journalists, and this is the norm. I met with people who come in knowing what they're going to write. And then all they're doing is just write.
Mad Libs thing.
Yes, it is. That's not a journalist. A journalist could come in and say, I think I know what's going on. Are you willing to see it from a different perspective? If you walk up to something and you're like, that's not what I thought. Are you willing to say it? Many are not.
Right. And I'm sure we'll get really into the journalism aspect of it, because that is one of my big takeaways from this. But I just think about that objectivity being my North Star, and the more experience I have, the more I feel this way. It's not like, oh, I become more jaded. There's no such thing as objectivity. In terms of colorblindness, because you said 80% of people are colorblind. I don't know. You were just throwing. Yeah. But like, I mean,
we're not.
Whatever
now.
The number is.
Yeah.
I'm sure, or I'm not sure, but I'm open to the idea that on some subconscious level, these things do impact us. But that doesn't mean that the rules are thrown out. That's still the goal. I thought the goal was still colorblindness.
You know, it's amazing to me. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. People say the opposite about that Martin Luther King did. Martin Luther King said, live up to that standard. That's our mission statement. This is, hey, King, we got to part ways because you don't even know who we are. Okay, you think we're like you. We're not like you. We have this whole different idea. We think this. And so we're going to create a government that tries to do that.
Right.
Okay. If we could accomplish that, it's time for a new mission statement. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's time for a reach of a goal. This is such a reach for a goal. We're throwing this out and saying, well, that won't work. Well,
right.
Wait. Of course, it's never worked, but are we getting closer or farther away?
Right. No, you're totally right. And it's that. It's there's something aspirational about it. It is
yes.
a mission statement. And I'm definitely not ready to burn down the house and try to start a new mission statement. I think it's a good challenge. I think it's a good comfort that's the goal, that's what hopefully society is trying to provide you with. But there's a lot of people who just seem to have this mentality that seems foreign to me, where it's like, well, if not everyone, you know, not everyone has life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, or doesn't have it equally, so we need to just go back to the drawing board. And then you have to get to the opportunity cost also of, okay, maybe this isn't the best way, but what's the better way? Oh, well, we'll figure that out.
Churchill said this is the worst system, except everything else that's ever been done. And it's true. It's true.
I agree.
Yeah. All right. So I want people to read the book because it's a fantastic book. But it changes halfway through, because you're telling this great story of this entrepreneur and tech and how it's all working. And then Donald Trump appears.
Right. Yeah. I mean, of course, I could never have prognosticated Trump would be part of the story just because I didn't think he was going to be running for president. Though, to Palmer's credit, you know, we talk about visionaries as people seeing the world differently and sort of being a little ahead of the curve. I still think it's amazing that in March 2011, Palmer posted online that Donald Trump was thinking about running for president in the 2012 election, that he was very supportive of that and thought it would be a great idea.
That's
and
crazy.
I remember he said that to me the first time. I was like, wait, this is from 2015. And he's like, no, it's from 2011. I was like,
I remember seeing him come down the escalator going, this is crazy.
Yeah.
This is crazy. But he saw it way in advance.
Him and I think Peter Thiel, not as soon, but Peter Thiel is one of the other people that I, you know, spoke with to some degree because he's on the Facebook board, but, you know, talked about his Trump support. And you know, these are the kinds of people who there's of course a luck aspect to the success of entrepreneurship, but then you see, all right, these people see things differently in a way where they can feel something becoming a part of the zeitgeist before other people do. So when we saw Trump come down the escalator, and we're like, oh my God, this guy's going to be a joke. Good fodder for the Daily Show. Nope. They see actually how it can resonate. Speaking of Peter Thiel, the other thing I was thinking about the other day that I thought was interesting was, you know, Marc Andreessen, another famous venture capitalist, from Andreessen Horowitz. He had, given an interview, not with me, but it was a podcast, you know, something I listened to in 2017. This was shortly after Palmer was fired from Facebook. And he talked about how this is a guy who knows everyone in Silicon Valley. And he said, there's only two people I know in Silicon Valley who are publicly Trump supporters or who are willing to say that they're Trump supporters: Palmer Luckey and Peter Thiel. And that's obviously a problem for a lot of reasons, because I think that there's more than two that are just, we're unwilling to say it. But it's interesting to me that now here we are in 2019, less than 2 years after he said that, and both Peter and Palmer are out of Silicon Valley. And it's not because they don't like the geography there. It's because there's other stuff going on.
So he posts his support for Donald Trump, and it's not crazy, is it? When he first comes out and says, I'm for Donald Trump, it's not, he's not like,
well, it was crazy back in 2011, because who would have
thought? Yeah, I know. But I mean, when this story really starts to take, he's sold his business to Oculus, and he's not like, you know, in the Trump gear and, you know, walking down Facebook, you know, with flags and going,
actually, he is much more like how I remembered politics when I was growing up, where I remembered I once asked my home economics teacher, which I would suspect is not really a class anymore, even though I thought it was very useful to learn those skills. And I remember asking her who she voted for in the election. I guess I was in eighth grade. It must have been 96. And she got mad at me. Like, that's a very personal thing to ask. You don't ask people about politics. And that's sort of Palmer's mentality, which once he was, you know, it was determined that he was a villain, everyone thought, oh, that's him being sneaky. He doesn't want to talk about his politics. No, that's just, he doesn't think that matters. He was there to do virtual reality stuff and do cool tech stuff. That was irrelevant. But yeah, he had no qualms with publicly being a Trump supporter. Not long after the escalator introduction of Trump, you know, one of the things I find fascinating that it's not in this edition of the book, but I will put in a later edition because I'm still getting
information,
more information. Fortunately, no contradictory information, but I'm still getting other cool details that I want to include is that in April of 2016, Palmer went to a Trump rally in Costa Mesa. And the reason I know that is not just because he told me, but because there was an NBC video talking about protesters outside of the rally, and Palmer was one of the people interviewed as like, you were at this Trump rally, what was it like, or what was the protesters like? So he had no problem being,
he wasn't hiding.
Yeah, he wasn't hiding, exactly, he wasn't hiding it. He knew this was going to be on the news, potentially millions of people would see it, potentially no one, but like, he had no problem hiding it. And then we flash forward to 5 months later when he makes this $10,000 donation to an organization, and he does it anonymously, which people then say he did it because, you know, he was sneaky about it, or he was trying to cover it up, or whatever they say. And you have to ask yourself, well, then what changed over the 5 months? And the answer is Peter Thiel. The answer is that in between that was the Republican National Convention in 2016. Peter spoke there and came out as a Trump supporter, as a gay man Trump supporter. And people on Facebook wanted to get him fired from the board at Facebook. For the only reason was just that he was a Trump supporter.
Shouldn't? I mean, I was not a Trump supporter at that time, and I saw that, and I thought, I don't understand what Peter is seeing here, but what a cool moment! What a cool moment for a gay man,
right?
Successful to stand up in front of a whole bunch of people that supposedly hate gay people, and he's got this warm reception. And he speaks openly about it. This is a great thing. May not like his candidate, but this is a good moment.
I totally agree. Because some of my reluctance over the years to embrace Republican candidates or you know, why I wouldn't be tempted to the dark side was because so many of my close friends are homosexual. And there's always felt like, for various reasons, that they were unwelcome. I think it's still a work in progress, but it's changing. And one thing I want to mention, that speaking of Peter, is, you know, I feel like someone might say, oh, Glenn and Blake, you guys are being hypocrites. You say that identity politics is all the stuff, and then you're, you know, giving Peter extra credit because he's a gay man, or that, you know.
Well, I think there's something to recognize when somebody breaks a wall, and Donald Trump and Peter Thiel broke a pretty big wall.
For sure.
Pretty big wall.
No, totally agree. But it just reminded me of something that Peter once said to me, where we were talking about diversity, and he said, he's like, don't get me wrong, I think diversity, I'm not going to be verbatim quoting him here, the gist was that he said diversity is important. It's just on the list of like 40 thing on the list of things to make a company successful, it's like the 40th most important. So it's not that we should pretend like diversity is irrelevant. We just need to get our priorities straight. And I think that there's a lot of merit to thinking about things that way.
Diversity really only counts when it affects your thinking. If I can't relate to being a gay man, okay, diversity is important because they'll have a different viewpoint. You know what I mean? But we're looking for exactly the same viewpoint, just in a different body.
Right.
It doesn't make sense. It's like, you know, it's like if GM makes every car exactly the same, just puts different bodies on it.
Right.
It's a Ferrari. No, it's not. It's a GMC truck.
No, that's really an analogy. And one thing that's kind of sad, scary, no, more so sad, but you think, like, the idea of groupthink is not that crazy because we're all humans. We all want to, you know, there's, you know, fear and shame that kind of push us in these directions. We want to be accepted members of society. So it makes sense why we have this instinct. But it's so weird to me that in Silicon Valley, where you had Steve Jobs and this sort of this think different ethos, this rebellion mentality, and now it's like, everyone's rebellion, but I just imagine like 50 Fonzies. And it's like, we're all rebels. The exact same kind of rebels. Hey,
right.
And so it's like, Really? And that's what I found really fascinating with this book, among many aspects of why I was happy in retrospect that it did swerve the way it did, because I thought of Silicon Valley as this renegade place of people who thought differently. And it's like, no, think differently, but as long as it's the same way. and then, you know, if you're thinking about just taking a step back of like, you know, America has always been, you know, such a great place for innovation and you know, there's, it's not a shock that a lot of these tech companies have been homegrown and thrived here. But what does that mean for the future of technology and our leadership or of the younger people out there that, you know, they're probably not going to be as likely to go to Silicon Valley to disrupt if you have to disrupt it in a certain way and not really disrupt.
But it also is. You know, it's why cloning eventually is really bad after a while, because there's no diversity at all. And then it just dies out because it's just, it's not capable to adapt to anything else. If you're not including everybody in that, it's ripe for disease.
Right.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong, because it was a few years ago when you met with Facebook and with Mark, but I feel like I remember you saying, like there was some talk about, oh, there should be a certain number of conservative people on the news council, and then it was, then you were like, no, that, then we're just doing the exact thing we stand against. And, yeah. And so I actually remember really like respecting you saying that, because that was a great point.
I got into a lot of trouble for it, but I sat there. And I'll never forget, I was sitting right here with Mark, big long table and all these people, and they started in on, well, we need to have quotas for people. Yeah. And I looked down there and I looked at Mark and I looked back down and I'm like, no, we don't need quotas. No,
yeah,
quotas
conservatives, bad. Finally, we're on the side of quotas. Yeah,
let's just talk to each other.
Right.
Let's just get to know each other. How about you not hire conservatives if they happen to be the right person.
Right.
You know what I mean? How about you just recruit for the best person?
Right. And that's where the book really did just become about discrimination. And like I think I said earlier in this conversation, I told you before, like, you know, it's not that I think Palmer is an incredible human and he's going to go on to do successful things. But I've had people say, oh, why should I feel bad for him? He's a multi-millionaire. He's now has another company. And my point is not to make you feel bad for him. It's to see that he just represents something that's happening in so many other ways, but he's a visible example. And he's an example that after, you know, 500 pages, you'll at least understand where he's coming from.
And how many people have had this happen to them on a much smaller scale that don't have billions of dollars, you know, millions of dollars. There's a lot. And more and more all the time.
Right. And the different, and one of the key distinctions to me, anecdotally, with the discrimination against conservatives in Silicon Valley is that at least before this sort of became more of an issue and people realized it was wrong to discriminate, or at least that they shouldn't publicly say it, a lot of people had no problem saying it. Like, it was just like, oh, well, we know the conservatives are the wrong ones.
Right.
Whereas they would never say that about someone of a different gender or a different religion, because they'd at least have the tact to say the right thing. But this was like, it was so beyond the pale to be conservative that they don't even have to, you know, put on the airs of the formalities of that's a valid way of looking at the world.
So when did you, because when this started happening with Donald Trump, let's just tell a little bit of the story.
Sure.
Palmer is told to write something that he didn't believe by Mark Zuckerberg. Why don't we go there and then tell me where you came in, where you're like, wait, what was your first inkling that you're thinking?
Sure.
Hold it. This can't be it. Right.
Yeah. Well, so I'll tell it from, I'll give some very brief background that in, you know, September 22nd, 2016, or I'll even just tell it from my perspective. I get a bunch of text messages on September 22nd, 2016. It's 9 o'clock for me, 6 o'clock Pacific. And it's all these people.
PM?
Oh, PM.
Okay.
So it's the evening of the 22nd, a few days after Palmer had just turned, I think, 23, or 24. And I get all these messages being like, oh, your book's in trouble, because there's a Daily Beast article with the headline about Palmer. That's the headline is Facebook billionaire secretly funding Trump's meme machine. And between that article and then the 50 other articles that spewed up over the next 24 hours from premier outlets. These weren't just like random blogs. It was Business Insider, Wired, The Verge, all these places. They were saying that Palmer had been funding this troll army that was making memes, and that everything you'd seen that was misogynistic, anti-Semitic, hateful, that Palmer was like ground, you know, patient zero, that he was like funding this thing, which was
Let's go back, because it's my understanding of reading the book that he was actually just responding to something that the left was doing, putting up these billboards that were, if Trump were so rich, how come he didn't buy this billboard?
Right, right.
Something like that. And so he was just like, that's funny, and I'm on the other side, and we should do that too, right? It wasn't a meme machine, and it wasn't, these were not bad things that they were putting out, were they?
I mean, I guess it's in the eye of the beholder, but he donated to an organization called Nimble America. In the entirety of Nimble America's existence, which had been started only 5 days before this happened, all they ever did was put up one billboard in Pennsylvania with the three words, too big to jail, and a caricature of Hillary Clinton's face. You know, like it was, you know, if you have a problem with that, then I have a problem with you, because that is like as tame as, you know, I mean, political advertising.
Adams said, if Jefferson is elected president, your children's heads will be on pikes and blood will run through the streets. So, I mean, too big to jail is...
Yeah, so we're definitely not even in that territory. Right. And one of the interesting things... And so this organization, Nimble America, was founded by an individual who I interviewed several times throughout the course of the book, because I was really curious about his perspective. You know, he was the one who started this, and I don't, you know, he it's a man, but he uses a pseudonym. I provide a pseudonym for him in the book because he didn't want any professional consequences. But I will say that after years of speaking with him and interviewing him for the book, I finally met him in person a week and a half ago, and I met him and his wife and his two kids. His wife is Filipino. He's described in every article as a white supremacist, and I guess maybe some white supremacists can have Filipino wives. That seems unlikely to me, but he's not a white supremacist. I will bet my life on that. I am always shocked, even with Palmer. I'd have journalists, the ones that were still willing to speak with me, say. I remember one conversation that after 2 hours I just thought was the biggest waste of time, where they say, so is Palmer a white supremacist? And I say, I can't tell you what's in his heart, but as someone who knows him better than almost anyone in the world, absolutely not. And there's no evidence to support this. And then I would explain here's what Nimble America actually was. Here's why that's ridiculous. Here's, you know, the first few people that Palmer hired at Oculus were an Indian guy, an Asian guy, a bisexual guy. Like if you're looking for hate, Palmer's not the source, not the guy. And then after 2 hours of this one particular conversation, the guy says, yeah, but what's the smoking gun? And I was like, the smoking gun to disprove something that's not true? No such thing exists. And then he walked away skeptical. And I was like, wow, I just spent 2 hours talking to this guy. Why? He clearly was, there's nothing I could say that could change his mind, because he's certain of something, even though he hasn't done the research. And that's, I guess, just goes to
How do you, that had to have boggled your mind, because you knew a lot of these people, you respected the journalists, and they knew you. They knew you're not a dope. You've got a good reputation, and you're saying, no, guys, you got it all wrong. How? I mean, it really sucks, because this happened to me, too. It sucks when you find out the guys you hold up and go like, oh, come on, we're all great guys.
Right.
All of a sudden, you're like, okay, no, I'm not with them. That sucks.
Right. Yeah, I felt a little bit prepared for that, because I saw what happened to Palmer, and I could, you know, like I said, anything that happened to me, I knew would never be as bad as him. So having this, wasting 2 hours of my time realizing that this approach was not persuasive to someone like him, not the worst thing in the world. Maybe that helped sharpen my knives for, you know, information in the book. Another thing that I thought about a lot was George Orwell's book Animal Farm. He wrote an original foreword for the book that was not included, and I don't think it's still included, that, you know, the whole book is about essentially the dangers of totalitarianism and right-wing nationalistic thinking. But he talked in this foreword about the dangers of liberal totalitarianism and how it's much more subtle, and how he wanted to, you know, he had wanted to say some critical things about the left. And you know, he was a democratic socialist, I think, or a socialist, but like he wanted to say some critical things in the same spirit that I sometimes do to help the cause. And people at publishers didn't want stuff published. They basically were like, that's just not done. Like we don't do those things. And so there's this like this chilling effect of people know not to like they know to ignore me because I'm not towing the party line. And to your question about what it was like, you know, I mean, it's not fun. You've been through it, I'm sure, much worse than I have. But it also is sort of like affirming, like okay, I am spending, you know, 80 hours a week working on this book. I'm doing something important here because I'm not going to maybe change that guy's mind. Hopefully I will, but I'm going to change other people's minds, or at least I'm going to get the truth out there. And I think that some people will actually go through the metamorphosis that I did, that actually saw, you know,
what it was.
Yeah, what it was, saw through the lies in the media, and that it really is just a matter of, like, it's all so much, people will talk so much about empathy for others, and empathy, at least to me as a storyteller, is like just understanding the perspective of someone else. And so as long as they're not acting in bad faith, I think you should be respectful of different opinions, and I do think that the book, which you've helped get into so many more people's hands, the reviews are much better than my first book. And my first book had very good reviews, but like, you know,
a very lot of, successful.
Yeah. But people seem to be loving it and seem to be, the message is getting through. And I think that's important.
How did you get so much access to emails that should never have been seen?
Well, I guess the good thing about startups is that there's usually multiple founders, and they usually end up not end up being the best of friends, and they all want to make sure that they get their stake of the credit, and you can work amongst them to try to get what you need. That I guess is not necessarily true of the stuff at the end of the book, like Mark. I guess we didn't even get to it, but you know, at the end, after these articles, inaccurate articles came out, Palmer wanted to write a statement saying that he supported Trump and that these articles were wrong. He was not allowed to post that statement. Instead, he had to post a statement that was written by Mark saying that Palmer supported Gary Johnson, which was not true. And that was a whole other... Finding out the truth on that was a whole other thing. I guess I failed to really answer your question, but what it was like for me... So I knew that Palmer at that point was a Trump supporter. I found it hard to believe that he had given money to something hateful that seemed out of context. But you know, I got to be open to the possibility. So I did my research. I talked to him about whatever he was allowed to talk to me about, because there was, you know, I do have a good relationship with him, but for legal purposes and for, at that point, keeping Zuckerberg secret purposes, there was a lot that he couldn't say. But I do remember being very surprised that he would say he's a Gary Johnson supporter when he wasn't, because honesty is so important to Palmer. Like he really is like a principled person who'd rather, you know, go down fighting, you know, but standing on a principle than sort of like sell out a little bit and get his objective. And then the other thing I noticed was that, you know, because like you mentioned, I got so many emails in the course of writing this book, and sometimes people would give me, you know, to avoid a paper trail, they would take photos of the emails and send them to me, and then I would transcribe them. And so I had a lot of practice transcribing email chains that often Palmer was on. And I hated the fact that he does such an annoying thing. He uses two spaces after a period, which is an old school typewriter thing.
You I had so much respect for you because I wrote you an email and you wrote back and you said, this is how I knew Palmer didn't write the email, because you do the same thing. I put two spaces between the paragraphs.
I think you use like three spaces sometimes. Yeah. And I noticed that every Facebook post Palmer had ever done prior to that had two spaces after a period. But this one that said things that didn't sound like they were coming for him had one space, which was a mistake that Zuckerberg and the Facebook team made. That said, at that point, I didn't think like, aha, this is a whodunit, and it probably goes to the top. I just assumed that Palmer like worked with a PR, you know, the PR team there and sort of gave them more of the autonomy. I assume that he was on board with this. I didn't realize it was against his will and that it went all the way up to Mark. And then what ended up happening was, like, flash forward a year or so later, and I'm working towards the end of the, you know, the latter half of the book, and I had these great relationships and contacts at Facebook and Oculus, and I said to them that I need, you know, Palmer is no longer the company. I believe he's fired, but you guys say he exited and won't say anything. But either way, I need to provide some explanation for what happened. I can't just say, you know, this guy who's been the main character for 400 pages, oh, now he's not here. So I really impressed on them how important it was that I got more information, and that they seemed to, I would assume they went back and huddled and were like, okay, we got to give this guy a story. And I got a story of how Palmer chose to leave, and it was given to me not just by one person but by several people in a systematic way that was meant to definitely provide me with a false conclusion of what happened and give me confirmation. You know, I'm a journalist, so I have 1, 2, 3, 4 people saying the same thing, and as I think I mentioned to you on the show, like, and Palmer couldn't talk to me about this,
so they had nowhere to go.
So even if I thought stuff was fishy, I couldn't say, Palmer, this is fishy. Is this wrong? He would say, like, I'm sorry, I'm not allowed to talk to you about that. So I was, you know, my spidey sense was like, something's wrong here. But I didn't know how to get to the truth. So as you know from reading the book, I have a narrative nonfiction writing style in which I don't attribute the quotes to the person that provided it to me, but to the actual speaker. You know, it's, I want you to feel like you're in the room and in the minds of these people. And so I had a feeling that they were taking advantage of my writing style in that it would never trace back to them, and that they were essentially laundering this misinformation through me, these executives at Oculus and Facebook that were telling me the same story that I believed was not complete, or at least, or might be false. And so I wrote, I guess you could call it like a fake chapter, a chapter that was just a straight up Q&A with one of these executives. And I told them, look, it was after Ted Cruz had asked Zuckerberg during the hearings about Cambridge Analytica stuff. He asked about Palmer and if Palmer was fired for political reasons. And Mark said, no, that had nothing to do with it. And I said to these people that, you know, now there's like widespread speculation that politics had something to do with it. You guys have all told me that it had nothing to do with it. And I believe you, of course, but I don't, and I don't want this is a really important topic. So I don't want what's in the book to be Blake Harris author's opinion. I want it to be straight from the horse's mouth. So I'm going to do 6 chapters that are just Q&As with executives.
Oh my gosh. And brilliant.
And here's the first one.
It's brilliant.
And so thank you. I was pretty proud of that. Yeah. And so I sent that to them, and then immediately got a call, like, or, you know, an email, like, can you jump on the phone? We need to talk. And that led to, within a matter of days, they told everyone at Facebook and Oculus to stop speaking with me. So that alone, of course, didn't confirm that my hunch was correct, but it did give me a strong sense that I might be. And it gave me the ammunition to go to a lot of people that were at Oculus and Facebook who felt that Palmer had been wronged, but hadn't been willing to speak with me or hadn't been willing to get me documents because they were fearful of losing their job. But once I said, like, look, here's the lie, or here's the information I'm being told that I think is a lie, this is what's going to be in the book unless you guys help me. And they really did step up to the plate. And I always appreciated that it was people, Trump supporters and Hillary supporters. Like, people were volunteering this information to me, not because they were trying to help the team, but because they felt that what had happened to Palmer was wrong. And after seeing what they got me, I completely agreed. And I had trouble believing that it really, that Mark personally wrote the statement. I mean,
how'd you verify that?
Trying to make sure I protect people. Anyway, I can say that there was an email that came from the general counsel at Facebook that went to Palmer's attorneys, that said, here's the statement. Mark personally wrote this.
Wow.
I guess to be specific, it said it was drafted by Mark himself. So in case that might mean something different, but like, and I was just like, oh my God, that I couldn't believe that. I couldn't believe that Mark would really do that, that he would micromanage this and force an employee to lie. I also couldn't believe that he really had such a problem with the truth. And then I also just couldn't believe that he was so stupid, or his lawyer was so stupid, to put it in writing. Like, if you guys are going to be, your digital mafiosos, at least be better
good.
About it.
Yeah. At least be good. So he loses his job. He loses his baby, Oculus. What's the future of Oculus? Let's start there. What's Facebook is
good question.
Not really.
Well, it's hard to even agree or not with the Facebook is like we see all these scandals with Facebook come out. But at the same time, they've had pretty good earnings reports and their stock has rebounded. So I can, this is speculation, like not coming from sources, but I can also just see Mark and Cheryl and the leadership team there being like, who cares? Yeah, we got some bad ink, but like, it's not affecting our bottom line. Let's just keep doing the stuff we've been doing. What's to stop them?
Why would Mark Zuckerberg be repeatedly asking now for regulation?
I think it's because, I mean, he's a smart guy. He sees the writing on the wall. There has to be some form of or it doesn't have to be. I think that he sees that it's very likely that there's going to be some form of intervention or regulations. Somebody's going to step in from on a governmental level. And one, it's good for him to be out front in that. And more importantly, all those things that he asked. All the things that he asked are going to help Facebook and Google and hurt small competitors, because it's the small competitors that aren't going to be able to comply with this stuff, or that aren't going to be able to keep up.
It's exactly what FDR did with the big three automakers that put everybody out of business, because he went to the big three and said, What do we need? What do you need? Let's come up with some regulations. And they did, and they came up with everything that they could do that the small guy couldn't, and put them all out of business.
Didn't know that. I'm going to look more into that, because it sounds exactly like that.
It is. Look at the number of cars, Auburn's. Look at the cars that were made up until the big three automakers got together. Same thing with BF Goodrich and Goodyear Tires. They put great tire companies, a great tire company, I think, in New Jersey out of business that had a cheaper tire and a better tire. But because of the new regulations, they were out. Which brings me to kind of a frightening scenario that I want to run by you. Google, Facebook, Apple, Amazon. They have more information on us than we would have ever dreamt that we would just hand over. I remember saying, government asked for me my fingerprint. I'm not giving my fingerprint. They're not fingerprinting people, but I'll give it to Apple. You know, I will stand there and give my face, my facial recognition.
What were we thinking?
Well, it's crazy. Okay. So now when regulation comes in, they can come in and they're going to be the experts that Washington calls. Washington knows they need them because it's just such a powerful tool.
Right.
Amazon and everybody else knows they need Washington. So they start to partner. You're looking at a very different America. When you have, it's everything I always made fun of liberals. I used to be like, can you stop with a corporation? The dystopian, 2045, everyone works for the corporation. You're like, oh, shut up. It's what's happening. And Facebook doesn't have to worry about the Bill of Rights. Amazon doesn't have to worry about it. Google doesn't have to worry about it. because the Bill of Rights apply to the government.
Right.
And if they decide to ban you and you can't buy products, you can't speak, you can't do all the things that China is currently doing, but it's just being done by a corporation.
Right. No, it's a good point. It's a good concern. One of my favorite television shows of all time is, it's not a super popular one, but it's called Psych, and it's about a psychic detective. Mm-hmm. It's on the USA Network. Mm-hmm. And there were police consultants who were allegedly psychic, and I always just thought it was interesting because, you know, the police has certain rules and protocols they have to follow, but consultants, it's a, you
mm-hmm.
know,
it's a gray area.
Oh, they decided to walk into that apartment and right. obtain some stuff.
Sure.
And that's like exactly the scenario you're describing, where mm-hmm. the US government, hopefully they're following the rules and guidelines, but you know, there's a mutually beneficial relationship to be had between them and the big tech companies. So, you know, maybe backs are getting scratched. Maybe they're getting what they need. And so I think Mark is aware of that. That's part of the reason also that you know, he wrote that op-ed in the Washington Post asking for regulation. And then the other reason, too, is like it's just asking other people to do your job. You know, they're banning people. Facebook has not shown themselves to be, you know, caring that much about principles. They're more reactive. Mm-hmm. I mean, even the people they banned, it's not like those are the people saying the worst things. Those are just easy targets. And so, you know, people on Twitter always say, oh, Jack, how are you letting this happen? Or, oh, Mark, why are you letting this happen? How great would it be for Mark and Jack if they're like, look, it's not us, it's the government. Those are the bad guys. We're the good guys here. And that gets also to the accountability issue, which is a huge part of this and a huge part of my concern about the future of Silicon Valley. And the other thing I think is interesting is like, you know, like you said, like, oh, the year is 2045 and everyone works for the corporation. Why would they hire us? They'll have robots. Like I think about, you're talking about the big three automakers. I don't know the exact numbers, but I imagine that their workforce was in the hundreds of thousands at the heyday, and they were, you know, some of the biggest companies in the United States. And now you have Google and Facebook, some of the biggest companies in the United States. Their workforce is so small.
Yeah.
Like that, you know, that's part of the answer of where the jobs are going, is that there's not as many jobs.
That makes it, to me, that has made it, I've talked about this for years, that makes the collusion between tech and government so huge, because at one point, I mean, tech has a goal, and I think it's a great goal. 100% unemployment. Nobody has to work, you know? Okay. But that's not the goal of politicians. Their goal is 3.6 or, you know, 0% unemployed. So they're going the opposite direction. At some point, somebody's going to realize those jobs aren't coming back.
Right.
Okay. When that happens, the politician is always the weakest in the chain, and he's going to need a bad guy, and he'll say, well, it's those people in Silicon Valley and their evil AI or AGI, and they're building these robots. They're putting you out of work. They're not going to be waiting for pitchforks. These people know what they're doing. They know what these guys will do. They'll come together. They have to protect each other. And it leaves a lot of people out. You know, it's corporate socialism. They get wealthy and they do everything else, but we get scraps.
Well, I'm not an avid reader of dystopian fiction, but I do feel like the sense I get from stuff nowadays is that there is this vision of corporate socialism where, you know, people associate more with like being a citizen of Google than they do of being a citizen of New York or the United States.
The human race.
Right, or the human race. And you know, that's where stuff, the fact that Facebook is developing a cryptocurrency, which, you know, cryptocurrency alone is a fine thing. It's a tool like all technology. But like, what's their plan here? And it does feel like they are thinking of themselves as a government, and that might be good or bad, but it is bears repeating what your point that like they're not bound by the same rules as
they're not bound by the Bill of Rights.
Right.
They can silence anyone they want.
And they have, you know, like just they did a recent wave of bans a week or so ago, and you know, like Milo Yiannopoulos, Alex Jones again, I guess. Like Laura Loomer.
What was really frightening is they went a step further. they said, if you support them, if you're a supporter and you are actively defending them, you also could lose your status on Facebook.
Right. And that gets closer to my fear. It would take a lot for me to be persuaded that deplatforming is a good strategy.
It's a horrible strategy.
Like Alex Jones, maniac, but he is entitled to speak his truth.
Let me use this because Alex Jones actually claimed in 2004 or 2005 that I was a CIA operative that was put into the media to cover up 9/11. Okay. So, and don't ask me any questions on that or I'll have to kill you. So I have no love for Alex Jones. The same thing with Louis Farrakhan. But Louis Farrakhan has been around my entire life and he's been saying crazy things.
Right.
And I like to hear those crazy things because he's saying them to a lot of people.
Right.
You know, I want to know what he's saying. Same thing with Alex Jones. I don't agree with it. I think it's dangerous, but I want to know what he's saying to people.
Right.
And know that he's got an audience. You just make these people disappear. We have no idea. And by the way, it's my responsibility to check it out or to not listen to those things I don't like. Isn't it?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I would be more sympathetic to Facebook taking actions if it was like, you know, you cultivated the Glenn Beck page on Facebook and you're being bombarded with people who you don't want in there who are like making it your problem. You know, like it's not like they can, there's, you know, like you have to confront an Alex Jones if he's posting on your page. Mm-hmm. I still don't know what the solution is, but what I find interesting is that they are doing this, you know, removing these hateful citizens, you know, in the name of like trying to reduce extremism. That's, you know, like reduce hate, reduce extremism. And reading, you know, like the manifestos of the New Zealand shooter and some of these recent attacks, like at the synagogue in San Diego, I know we're not supposed to read the manifesto because it's supposed to pretend like it doesn't exist. But like, I find that I'm curious, where do they think they're coming from? And paraphrasing here, but like they think that they have mentalities somewhat similar to Alex Jones, where they feel like the mainstream media is hiding things from them and that there's a conspiracy against people like them. And so is removing Alex Jones or Milo going to make them
worse?
Yeah. Isn't that going to radicalize them even more?
It's like, you know, there's this great movie out and I don't know how close it is because I don't follow England enough, but Benedict Cumberbatch, whatever his name is.
They're all acceptable.
All acceptable.
The handsome Sherlock Holmes guy.
I actually really love him as an actor, but he's in it. And it's called Brexit. And I saw it and I was like, they're going to make the Brexit people all look like racists. And,
right. You know.
And I watched it and they did. For me, at least as an American overseas watching it, I think they did a really good job. They showed that pocket of people that were racist. And that was one group. And then there was this other group that just felt like, hey, nobody's listening to me. Nobody's talking to me. They're calling me this, and I'm not that. You know what I mean? This is happening. There are identitarians out there who are very dangerous, but there are also people who are like, you know what? I'm Swedish, and I'm okay with that. I'm not saying Sweden is the greatest of all time. It's just my country, and I'm not a racist for flying my Swedish flag. Right. You know what I mean? There are tons of people on both sides of the aisle that feel that. And the example now with Brexit is, oh, maybe we should have another referendum. Maybe we should have another vote. Look, because you didn't like the first one? That's not the way it works.
Right.
And we're doing the same kind of thing. We're creating a much bigger problem. I was against Donald Trump, and I could not understand my audience. I was so angry with my audience. And I've always said I loved my audience because I do. They're some of the best.
By the way, I love them a lot, too.
Yeah, I know.
Thank you, audience.
Yeah, they're great people. They're great people. I couldn't understand when they went for Donald Trump because I was so blind on what I saw in Donald Trump. And I was so angry with them. And it took me about 6 months after the election before I realized, you don't actually love your audience. You say you do, but you don't. Because if you loved your audience, you would have said to them, this isn't like you. What the hell is happening in your life? Something big must be happening in your life. And when I got on the air and I said that to them, I found out they're scared to death about what's happening to their country. They're terrified about what's happening in their country. And a lot of the stuff they're worried about are the same things that many Democrats, I'm not talking about politicians, I'm talking about Democrats who live in our communities, they're afraid of the same kinds of things. And they don't know what to do, and no one's listening to them. So when somebody steps up and says, I'm just like you, even if he's not.
And he's very much not, or it appeared that way. No, you're totally right. And I'm glad I'll check out the Brexit movie, not just because I like Benedict Cumberbatch, but I'm glad that they didn't just paint it in broad strokes of, oh, if you're Brexit, you're racist. Because to your point, there are people like that, fringe.
Yes.
Small percentage, but like I did the same thing. I was devastated the night that Trump won the election, but I also took it as like I had hoped everyone would and said, okay, like my team What's didn't that? Win. What happened here? Because I don't think that half the country are idiots. Like what are they seeing that I'm not seeing? What are they caring about that I'm not caring about? And I remember, like, I reached out to some people on Twitter who were like, oh, you know, all you Democrats, you think I'm a racist because I care about this. And I was like, hey, I don't think you're a racist. Or, you know, I'm sorry if I felt you're, like, if I come across that way. And I remember telling my friend John, and I said, you know, I showed him some of these conversations I had. And I was like, there's a lot here that we're not getting in the media that actually is very reasonable and certainly not with malice. What is happening here? And he said, oh, wow, you're doing the thing that we all said we were going to do, which is reach across to the other side and actually talk to them. Whereas everyone else said that maybe for a brief while, and then they just doubled down on collusion, on we're smarter than them. They shouldn't have a vote anyway, or what do they know? And that's probably been one of the sadder things these past few years.
I've asked this of both sides. Imagine a world where the next election, your side, whichever side it is, wins everything. You got the House, you have the Senate, you have the White House. You pack the court with 40 new judges that rule exactly the way you want. 50% of the country is not going to want to live that way. What's your plan?
That's a great question. Great point.
Does both sides diametrically opposed? Well, you're going to have to become a totalitarian, and you're going to have to teach those people, or you're going to have to say, you know what? Let's go back to the Constitution because we hold these things to be self-evident over here, and you guys work it out.
I kind of feel like my initial answer, which is kind of like a joke answer, is like a reverse civil war. I feel like so many of my fellow liberals are like, well, then we don't want you. Like, start your own country, where it's like, no, you know, we fought a war 175 years ago to unite the country, to stay united. You know, united we stand, divided we fall. But now it's like, no, if you're not on board with this idea, we don't want you.
It doesn't. It's antithetical to everything the United States is supposed to be. I mean, we are supposed to be United States. I don't really care what California does. I really don't. I don't want to live there. I've wanted to live in California my whole life. But as a business person, I'm not living in California.
Right.
Okay, it'll bankrupt me to live in California. I don't want anything to do with it. So I don't care. San Francisco, poop in the streets all you want. I think you're wrecking a good city, but go ahead. Somebody else wants to carry, you know, open carry firearms down the street.
Right.
If that's what you want to do, go ahead. I may or may not want to live there either. But that's for each person to decide. It's fascinating to me that Vermont, very little news, 2011, you know what they did? They started their own state universal health care. Okay. A state-run universal health care did everything that they wanted the government to do. They did it. You know what happened? 2014, out of money. doesn't work. Had to increase taxes, I think, by 20 or 30%. The governor's like, that's crazy. We can't do it. So they stopped. Okay. The reason why we're asking the federal government to do things is for one reason. Why these states, California has a right to do it, do it. These states don't have the right to do one thing the federal government does, and that's
guns.
No.
Well,
print money.
Oh, I thought it was the Second Amendment stuff, because I'm sure California would like to ban guns, but that's at least
right. But yeah, what I'm saying is,
oh, yeah, you're right.
You can do any program you want. You should. We should have 50 different laboratories. And it's in Texas. If I saw something that was working, if Vermont could have made a go of that. And it actually worked, and it gave good health care, and it was cheaper, and it wasn't degrading the health care, I'd be in.
Yeah, I actually wanted, you're so knowledgeable about the history of the country, and this is a very broad question, so, but just like, of course, your understanding of, like, I remember growing up and seeing that movie, The Warriors, like the Warriors come out and play, and you got all these different gangs in the New York, like the baseball Furies. And I remember thinking, like, oh, that's kind of like the United States. You got like everyone's doing their own thing, yeah. and it works for them. When did people start so aggressively looking for a federal solution to saying, like, let that state do it, and if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. Also, it's not my problem. Like, I don't need to get involved in this.
It started with Theodore Roosevelt. It got really bad with Woodrow Wilson, the worst president ever. He was massively racist, horrible, horrible individual. And then it kind of reversed itself for a little period of time with Calvin Coolidge, who I think is one of the best presidents of the 20th century. And I think it was Coolidge. No, it was Hoover that came in, and there was a big storm that had happened and wiped out some part of some southern state. I don't remember what it was. And so the federal government, for the first time, sent in aid, and the trucks came, and the people in the town actually stood at the town road with shotguns and said, turn your federal trucks away. We don't want your help.
Wow.
Theodore Roosevelt, I have up in the vault in the library, I have a promotional piece from Theodore Roosevelt's presidency, and it's about this big, and it's a teddy bear, okay? And it has bullseyes all over it, and it was made for kids. And the reason why it was made for kids is he was trying to start a campaign to put a shooting range in every elementary school. Okay? Do you know why America rejected it? This is how much we've changed.
Cost too much? What?
They said, don't you dare tell us what we're supposed to do in our schools. So we've fundamentally changed. That's why we had the Bill of Rights and you know, FDR, Cass Sunstein, Barack Obama even talked about it. Changing the Bill of Rights to a document of positive liberties instead of negative liberties. The Bill of Rights in the Constitution is meant to be the state's best friend, the local's best friend. The government cannot ever do these things. You want to do them? Great. The federal government can never do these things. Okay? We've tried with FDR and his New Deal. He tried to flip this and say, here's what the government must do. That changes us fundamentally.
Right.
And that is what is forcing us to live a certain way. It's like, I hate, do you travel much?
No, I'm okay. Sort of a reckless writer.
Okay. I traveled a lot in the 80s overseas, and then I did again here in the last 10 years. The difference is crazy. I don't like it. I mean, you go to Rome, you might as well go to Epcot, because it's the Ann Taylor, and oh, look, there's the Gap. It's no longer Rome. You go to our towns now, all across America, same mall, same shop, same everything. We're all alike. We've erased the uniqueness of each individual state, and everything is just the same.
Right.
We weren't meant to be that way.
I mean, that's like a whole other bag of worms. It's tough because that's like like you see with Facebook and Google and Amazon, it's like the they end up being monopolies. Like, you know, right. I feel like 10 years from now, you'll go to Rome and say like, oh, Blake, there was no Ann Taylor. There was just like a little kiosk to buy stuff on Amazon.
Right.
Like, that's like where it's headed. Right. But
you know what? Amazon has given us a bigger, Etsy has given us a bigger market to look at. I want to buy real cricket bats. I don't know where I would have bought those before, but I can, you know. So it's given us that wide diversity, which is really good. But when you fold it into the government and we all have to have the same things, what's right in Amarillo, you know, New Mexico, is not necessarily what's right for Seattle, Washington.
I feel like it's like people who didn't have siblings or something. Like you know, I have a younger brother, and when I was a kid, you know, anytime he got something, I wanted it. Or, you know, like I judged myself by him. And then I grew up, and I assumed most people did, where it's like, I just hope he has what's best for him. It's not going to be the same as me. I don't really care. Like, as long as it's good for him, I don't, it's not my business. But that's not, I guess probably is more very tribal, like the why do people, like it's a victory to impose that will to feel like you're taking action. I don't actually know why people would care so much.
I don't think they do. I think we've been pushed into tribes so hard that we feel under attack. And so anything outside of our tribe is an enemy, when that's not true. I don't care what you do. I mean, I was painted as a anti-gay marriage guy for I don't know how long. Penn Jillette came onto my show with Fox, tried to trap me, and he was like, so, but why do you have a problem with gay marriage? And I'm like, I don't. What? I don't. I haven't had a problem ever with gay marriage. I'm a libertarian. I believe nobody has a right to tell me who I can marry, and I don't need a license or a blood test. Thank you very much. You know, Margaret Sanger and Woodrow Wilson for giving us those kinds of things. Thank you to Reconstruction for giving us the marriage license so we don't marry the wrong race. Abraham Lincoln didn't have a marriage license from the state. George Washington didn't have one. Why do I need one? I don't need one. Now I can live side by side with everybody. I'm fine. Just be cool, do your thing, and I'll do my thing. And can't we just all get along?
Yeah, I suggested to a friend the other day that he should start the Rodney King Alliance, just to try to get more people to get along. That was also my big takeaway too, from going from feeling dispirited by the election results to trying to feel inspired and bettering myself, and just thinking like, we are all in this together. I want the best for this president that I didn't believe in. I definitely not rooting against him. I want you guys to be happy.
We all win if he wins. And same with Barack Obama on the big issues. The big issues.
And I also do believe that more that we're just really hearing from the more vocal minorities, not ethnically minorities, but just like we're hearing from the loud vocal minorities, and I think that there is like 60-80% of people, more so in the middle, that are like, yeah, let's actually get along. I don't want to fight with you. But when the journalists on both sides, especially on the left, are in that 10% fringe extremist, mm-hmm. we need to control everything, it needs to be this, if it's wrong, if it's not way, like that is really slanting the way that people are perceiving reality.
Are you hopeful for the future of that? This a phase we're going through?
I think I'm a hopeful person in general, so that's sort of a bias that I have. And then I'm hopeful because I've yet to encounter a situation, and maybe I just haven't had many, where I actually talk to someone who should be my enemy, whether it's you or whether it's the guy who founded Nimble America. And when I actually talk to you or him or any of these people, there's so much common ground, and we want 95% of the same thing. And and importantly, they are not, or you are not, what I had in my head believing that you were. And then the other thing that has me hopeful is whether it's people reading this book or just me talking to them about what happened and explaining it, whenever someone actually is willing to give their attention span to have the conversation, they are persuaded. Like, you know, it is like a tribal instinct to hate this person or to like this person. But if you actually say, hey, why do you hate that person? Or why do you like that person? One-on-one, most people are willing to say, yeah, I guess you're right. If the other side did that, I'd be mad too. Or like, I think that people, I still believe in humans, I guess. Yeah. Like, so we just need to figure out, easier said than done, way to get our better angels and to actually want to have that solidarity. Because there are people out there that want to blow up the system, that want, that think that, you know, that fighting and arguing is, you know, emotionally arguing, not debating, is the solution, because the other side just needs to be defeated.
Last topic. When I first had you on the air, your book was at 33,000. I don't think I knew this until you were on the air, that you just couldn't get anybody in the mainstream media to talk to you about this book. And you are an accomplished author. I mean, you have one of the best books of the last decade out, and it's being made into a TV show or movie.
Well, that's understandable. It was, yeah. So I wrote this book about Sega and Nintendo called Console Wars, that is the all-time best-selling video game book, and it's a small field, which is part of why I wrote the book and part of why people really liked it. And it's being made into originally a movie, now a TV show with Seth Rogen and Jordan Voight Roberts is directing. So, like, you know, on paper, I was everything that a gaming journalist should like, you know, someone who actually got this to a mainstream audience, someone who's spent years doing the work, like. I actually did the work, like, and I was very well liked. I was, you know, named one of the 50 most admirable gaming people from one of the, you know, these big magazines in 2014 when my book came out. Yeah.
And then it didn't happen. So
yeah, 33,000. It was the book. Yeah. You know, the book was selling okay at first few weeks, and then oblivion until you changed my career. Until you went to basketball.
So has it changed? From them, now that it came back up, did you find anybody else that was, they were willing to take a look at it? And
that's an excellent question, because the book, you know, we went from 33,000 to number 2 on Amazon. I had, of every book, I would send this to my friends and they'd be like, oh, number 2 in what category? I'm like, the category of every book in the U.S. Like, ahead of Catcher in the Rye, ahead of The Fountainhead, ahead of, you know, Michelle Obama's book for a short while. And it was a, you know, a national bestseller, USA Today bestseller. And the week after it was, you know, named a bestseller, I put together an email working with the publicist at HarperCollins, mm-hmm. who published the book. And I gave her the names of like 150 journalists in tech and gaming world who were my friends, or who, you know, these were like personal emails, like people who I had conversations with, and said, you know, let's make another effort to reach out to them. Can you send them an email, basically saying that this book is a bestseller now? It's the highest ranked a video game book has ever been, and say, you know, I think she wrote something like, you know, what it's been getting headline, you know, it's been getting attention because of the political discrimination aspect. But in addition to that, there's also topics like, you know, the game company Epic just launched a store, and there was some internal documents from him talking to Zuckerberg. And so there was like 5 other topics that are super timely related to gaming and tech. And I was like, oh, I have an even better idea. Since Facebook is obviously the most interesting topic, I said, you know, a source had given me a cell phone recorded video of the day that Mark came to Oculus when they were being acquired for $3 billion. And he gives a speech, which is the prologue to the book, but the actual video. And I said, I've never shared this with anyone. Why don't I put that up on Vimeo, and we'll include a link. And if reporters are not going to report this, then we have no hope. Because this is like a video no one's ever seen.
Of Zuckerberg.
And Paul Murray even joked to me after I told him I sent this email, because we were curious, are the journalists going to finally acknowledge my book? And Palmer made the point that a couple weeks earlier, all these same outlets have been reporting on what was in Mark Zuckerberg's garbage. And so Palmer said, if they don't report on this video, let alone the book, then they would literally rather report on what's in Mark's garbage than any of the stuff that isn't that I spent years researching. And still, not a single person report on it. And I should say, you know, that is the mainstream tech and gaming press. Coming on your show and the success of the book reached, you have such a devoted group of listeners, and so many of them wrote nice letters to me. So many of them bought this book and supported the book and liked the book. And it also led to other conservative pundits, hosts having me on their show. So they've been really accommodating. And there's been people here and there that have had me on. I had a good conversation with the guy, David.
No.
Hopefully David Rubin.
Okay.
James O'Keefe mentioned the book on his show the other day, and I'm hoping to speak with Dave, because Dave actually...
I'll call Dave for you. Dave's a good friend.
Thank you. Dave's, for me, I definitely still consider myself a liberal, and I always think it's weird when you question that people, like Dave's called right or alt-right, even though... he's a gay guy. And then same thing with Joe Rogan and Sam Harris and all these people. But I remember, this has been sort of a journey for me of becoming more tolerant and sort of understanding what it means to be liberal, conservative. And Dave's video, Why I Left the Left, was really eye-opening for me. It did talk about the Martin Luther King Jr. quote that I think about a lot, and that was a very persuasive video. And there's a lot of people on the left now who feel like Dave or like myself, and I think we can do better than that. But anyway, yeah. I was gonna say that I was on this Geek's Guide to the Galaxy, which we had a good conversation, and I thought it was funny that the podcast is actually produced by Wired, though, like, they have no involvement, but so they ended up putting it up on their webpage, and I was like, oh, finally I got on Wired after they refused to have me on anyway. I kind of snuck on there, and during the conversation we talked about how Wired wouldn't have me on. But I just wanted to take another moment to thank your listeners.
They're the best. Blake, thank you
so much, Glenn.
Just a reminder, I'd love you to rate and subscribe to the podcast and pass this on to a friend so it can be discovered by other people.